Welcome to the Brighton Book Club, a monthly show on Radio Reverb, celebrating books and writing in Brighton and beyond. I am so excited about this. It's been really hard to keep under wraps, but we are partnering with the Coasters Queer Literature Festival this year, and we are going to revisit some of their great events in the lead up to this year's festival, which will take place at ACCA at the Sussex University campus from the 10th to the 13th of October this year. So if you don't know, the Coasters Queer is Brighton's annual festival of LGBTQ+ writing. It is the first of its kind in the UK, and it creates a space for queer writers and allies to come together in a grassroots celebration of the written word and its ability to illuminate and enrich the lives of our community. So on the first episode of this series, which I am bringing to you, we revisit an enlightening conversation about queer representation in commercial fiction hosted by the effervescent Tanya Byrne. I love Tanya Byrne so much. And Tanya is joined by Tasha Suri, wonderful writer of fantasy, and Laura Kay, who writes gorgeous queer romantic comedies. This conversation covers everything from the books that inspired them to growing up without queer literature representing women, to considering their teenage selves when writing, to book banning, and to the need for joy and hope in queer literature. Also, a really interesting discussion of whether or not straight people should write queer books and characters. I really hope this whets your appetite for this year's festival. Super early bird tickets are on sale now at thecoastisqueer.com, and you can sign up to the mailing list there to hear everything about the full lineup as soon as it's announced. Really hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did.
I just wanted to welcome you all here today to the second day of The Coasters Queer. It's really lovely to see you, and I'm very pleased to see that you all are up and about and at it so early in the morning. I'm here to introduce the Queer Representation in Popular Fiction panel with Laura Kay, Tasha Suri and Tanya Byrne. So I just want to tell you a little bit about Tanya, and then Tanya will go on to introduce the others, if that's okay. Get this, I'm reading from my phone, I'm so modern. So Tanya Byrne was born in London, where she spent 40 years before moving to Brighton with her dog Frida. After 8 years at BBC Radio, she left to write her debut novel, Heart-Shaped Bruise, which was published by Headline in May 2012 and earned her a nomination for New Writer of the Year at the National Book Awards. Since then, she has written 4 novels and has contributed to several short story anthologies, including A Change Is Gonna Come, which was named Sunday Times Children's Book of the Week. Her latest, After Love, is out now, and she's currently working with Two Rivers Media to adapt it for television, which is great news. So put your hands together, please, and welcome our panel for Queer Representation in Popular Fiction.
That is very enthusiastic for 11 o'clock on a Saturday morning. I do appreciate it. Thank you so much for coming out and having this conversation with us about queer representation in popular fiction, which if we'd had probably about 2 years ago would have been not a very long conversation, I don't think. But things are looking better, things are looking up, especially in children's and YA, and then also I think as well in rom-coms and commercial fiction. So we're going to have a good, uplifting, positive conversation about queerness and books, which intersect my two favourite things. So here we go. So I, just to let you know what's going to happen, we're going to talk for about 45 minutes, and at the end we're going to throw open to questions. We're about 10-15 minutes worth of questions, so do have a think about anything that you'd like to ask us, and then we'll come back to say our final thoughts, Jerry Springer style. So before we begin, I'm just going to introduce these guys. I'm actually going to ask you to introduce yourselves.
I'm Laura Kay. Wild Things, which is there, is my third novel. I write rom-coms. Wild Things is about a group of queer friends who move out into the countryside and start a queer commune. But it's also very much about how humiliating it is to have a crush on your best friend. And I'm currently working on my fourth book. And I don't know why I brought that up, because it's hell. I'm not enjoying it.
Yes. You're at that kind of eating cereal straight from the box with your bare hands and not showering for a couple of days stage.
That was me yesterday.
It's fun. It's a lot of fun. Right, Tasha, I'm going to stand this up.
I just feel like there was a really knowing like groan when you said the embarrassment of being in love with your best friend, but yeah, maybe we need to question the audience later.
I think this is a safe space, isn't it? I think we've all been there, haven't we?
I love the idea that there's like two friends sitting next to each other right now and
secretly
it's just
in love with each other and I haven't told each other.
Right now. Very awkward.
Trying to look into the audience.
Sorry.
Maybe the question at the Q&A is the time to pronounce your love for each other. Oh my God, I would die.
Please.
I would be so happy. Right, sorry, Tasha.
If Laura just made eye contact with you, it's you, just so you know. Hi, I'm Tasha Siri, and I mostly write fantasy novels, but I've also written a historical novel, and I've got a sci-fi coming out soon. It's a Doctor Who tie-in. It's October now, isn't it?
This
month. so that's really fun. So I am here largely to talk about the Burning Kingdoms trilogy, and book two came out in August last year, and that's The Oleander Sword. And the Burning Kingdoms trilogy is a South Asian-inspired fantasy novel trilogy about morally grey lesbians who work together to burn down an empire. So it's good fun.
I mean, come on. I mean, it sells itself, doesn't it? I mean, the queer commune is the dream as well, but burning down an empire, come on. Right. There we go. Look, it's like the Home Shopping Network. I've put them out for you to see. Right, so we are here to have a conversation about queer representation in popular fiction. So I think the best way to start that conversation, I think, is to ask you both what the first book that you read that you felt seen in a way that you hadn't been before. And if not a book, then maybe a film or a television character or a song or something.
Do you want me to go first?
Go on, Tasha.
Yeah. So when I was about 13, I read a book called Kushiel's Dart by Jacqueline Carey. If anyone has read that book, you shouldn't read it when you're 13.
I was just thinking about the books that we read before YA was a thing, like Flowers in the Attic and Stephen King.
So I used to visit a lot of family in India, right?
Okay.
And you couldn't... Well, at the time, the only English books that you could easily get access to, at least in my family, were Archie Comics, Sweet Valley High, and Flowers in the Attic.
Yes, Sweet Valley High was not my bag. I made everyone gay, but then it wasn't for me at all, so Flowers in the Attic was the only other option.
Yeah, and I was like, why is this one included? And I just remember... Well, I won't go into Sweet Valley High. That's not important. But Kushiel's Dart was about gifted masochistic courtesan spy who was bisexual and had relationships with a celibate, it didn't stay that way, priest, warrior. Gosh, was perfectly timed.
Shocking.
And a sadistic, blue-eyed, dark-haired Machiavellian woman. So that was my introduction to queerness, which I think was a good start.
I think that's an excellent start. Yeah. How old were you?
13.
Excellent. Good. Wholesome. Excellent. And how did you feel when you read that? What was it about it that made you think, hold on a second? Listen, let's not. It's 11 o'clock. There might be underage people. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, that sounds...
Don't get too R-rated about it.
I think what really spoke to me about it was, one, that it was, in a weird way, a really great introduction because it didn't say, you know, to be queer, you have to be good and kind and gentle and lovely. It said, sometimes the world is extremely messy and it's fun to tell messy stories. And I think that was the best introduction I could possibly have for me personally. I think that there is a really important space, and I love fluffy stories, but I think it's also important to say we can have stories that are aspirational and sweet and uplifting, but we can also have stories where we can be the hot messes that we deserve to be.
Are we going to talk about this a little bit later about kind of our hopes going forward? But I think, you know, we talk a lot about diversity in publishing and diversity in books and stuff. And I think, I mean, coming out stories are perennially popular. And, you know, every time a 14-year-old picks up a coming out story, that is the first time that they've read one. But I think we need everything. We need to be the villains, and we need to be vampires, and we need to be witches. It can't just all be about coming out and how difficult it is. And, you know, so love that. I love that, you know, the messiness, the realness of just being human, not queer, but just human, you know, and that intersects with queerness. So actually that makes sense about the sort of writing that you do, which is it's very rich and kind of complicated, and it's not as, well, you know, light and fluffy. But there's nothing wrong with light and fluffy, is there, Laura? We like
Thank
light
you.
And fluffy. See, did you see that segue there? That was professional.
That was gorgeous. No, there's nothing wrong with light and fluffy. Although the first time I remember reading about queer characters was not light and fluffy. It was, like a lot of young queer people, Sarah Waters' books.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I first read Fingersmith, and so, which was just so thrilling. Like, even take the queerness out, and it's so addictive, and it has one of the best twists of all time, and I just loved it. But when I was reading it, I'm not sure that I was aware that I was what I was taking from it as a young queer person. But I was so taken by it, and the sneaking around and the like forbidden nature of it all. Mm. And then I found the Tipping the Velvet TV series, and that was game changing, because then I actually did know what I was taking from it. Yeah. And like, again, yeah, it's 11 o'clock in the morning, whatever, blah, 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 blah. But I knew what I was getting from that. Yeah. It's like so sexy and like fun and outrageous. And that really spoke to me. But what I really wanted, because I mean, my favorite books when I was growing up were Louise Renison's Angus Thongs and Four Frontal Snogging.
And the snogging, yeah.
I don't think I still don't think I relate to a character as much as I do Georgia Nicholson. I think she's magic. And I also went to an all-girls school, and we were also massive dummies. And I was like, this is me in a book. And what I wanted was that, but gay.
Girls kissing the plot, basically, which is 100%. Every book I write.
Yeah, exactly. And same. So yeah, I guess that's like what I read and what I wanted to read.
I think sometimes it isn't necessarily seeing yourself on the page. It's the kind of space in between where you aren't seen on the page and you realise that actually this is what I need and I'm not getting it from this book. Because I grew up, I was born in 76, so I kind of came of age in like the 80s and the 90s, and I had pretty much nothing. Because in those days, queerness was male, you know, it was Boy George and George Michael and, you know, Andy Bell and people like that, and lesbians weren't really as, well, mainstream. They were around, of course they were there. So what I did was develop kind of fascinations on television characters. Like, I thought Lisa Bonet from The Cosby Show was like so cool, and I loved Hilary Banks, I thought she was so pretty. And what I didn't realize, and then Gillian Anderson from The X-Files was so amazing. But what I didn't realize was I was in love with all of them. But I just thought they were just, you know, cool characters, and it took a while. I mean, I didn't come out until I was 40, so I came out when, it's really complicated, but my mother is Guyanese, she's Indo-Guyanese, and she's Catholic, and she went to church every day, so she was like super Queen Catholic, and so basically I waited until she died before I came out, because we already had a pretty fractious relationship, and I was just concerned that I'd make it worse. So I was out to like close friends and stuff, but I wasn't out until she passed away. So I've had a very strange journey up until this point, and I have to say that it's just really nice to have these books now. And when I sit down to write, I always think about, what did the 16-year-old me need? And I always think, like with Afterlove, for example, if I'd had that book when I was 16, would I have come out earlier? So that's my thinking. Anyway, right, so that leads us neatly. I mean, this is so professional. Are you taking notes? onto your own writing. Do you think it was like a conscious decision to tell queer stories for either of you, or are you just writing what you know?
We should do rock, paper, scissors or something. It was a conscious decision for me.
Because, really?
Okay. Yeah, and what was quite interesting is when you were talking about, you know, one of the reasons why you didn't come out and that was unusual. I think the wonderful thing about being queer, or maybe the sad thing, is that all our stories are kind of unique and yet similar.
Yeah.
So I waited a long time to come out for a variety of reasons. I came out a little bit younger, but at the same time, there were a lot of family and cultural factors that made it really complicated. And I think there can be a lot of shame associated with that because you go, oh, I should be out, or, you know, oh, I shouldn't, and it becomes very complicated. So my first two books were very important to me, but they weren't queer at all. In fact, they didn't even have background queerness, and that was a conscious choice in a lot of ways. Mm. And then I made a decision that I was going to, like, to me at the time, be brave and write a story that was queer and felt very true to me. So when I came to the Burning Kingdoms and wrote a central lesbian relationship, that was a big step for me. And it feels wonderful that there are so many more queer stories in, like, the science fiction and fantasy space and in rom-com than there have been before. But at the time, that felt like a huge step for me to take. I'm glad I did it.
I'm very glad you did it. My first book, Heart-Shaped Bruise, came out in 2012. And I wanted the main characters to be queer, and it was my debut. I wasn't brave enough. And to be honest with you, I wouldn't be sitting here now if I'd written that book, because it wouldn't have been published, and that's a fact. So it did take me a while, and I was so scared, because I wasn't like out, and my mum was still alive at this point. I was so scared. I remember getting a review on Goodreads, and this is why authors shouldn't read Goodreads. They're not for you. And someone said that she thought that Emily was in love with Juliet. That's why she was behaving the way that she was behaving. And I was absolutely terrified that was going to be outed, because I was writing for YA as children's. And I thought, that's it. My career is over if anyone finds out. I mean, there are other authors that have said, like Patrick Ness and Jacqueline Wilson, that have now kind of come out. But for years, they were in the closet, Jacqueline Wilson in particular, because they were terrified that it would affect their careers if they were seen as, you know, nobody wants to write, you know, them to write children's books. So, yeah, I kind of get that why it took you a while before. I think it was my short story For a Change is Going to Come was the first queer story that I wrote, and now nothing can stop me. What about you, Laura?
I suppose it was and it wasn't a conscious decision. I sat down to write, and I kind of couldn't have written anything else. Like, I was writing what I knew, and a story that felt like it would be relevant to me and my friends. Like, when I started writing, I literally just wanted to write something that would make my friends laugh. Like, that was my primary goal. Yeah. And I am very lucky to be surrounded by queer people. I live in a lovely queer bubble. And so the characters were, of course, queer. That was the love stories that I had experienced and the people around me were experiencing. And it sort of didn't really occur to me to write anything else. And when I was writing it, I was quite naive. I didn't work in publishing. I didn't know anyone else that had ever been published or written a book. And I didn't realise, A, that I was writing a rom-com, because I was so unaware of genre, really, in terms of my own storytelling. And I certainly would never have categorised it as, like, a queer rom-com, which, like, publishing are, like, keen to put you in a box always. And so now to be, like, known for that specifically still feels really... Because, I feel like I write love stories and stories about relationships rather than having, like, the queer qualifier, which I'm, like, proud to have and happy to have, but I still think that's really interesting that it comes with that qualifier.
Yeah, I was saying to Tasha and Laura earlier, because I've got a new book out, there's a sampler on your chairs. I had a big marketing and PR meeting with my publisher on Wednesday, and all of the publicity is like, a sapphic love story, a sapphic love story. And I'm like, can we get rid of the sapphic and just make it a love story? And then they said, but no, it trends really well on TikTok. And I was like, oh, okay, fine. Like, can't argue with that logic. So, that's one of the things that I'd like to discuss later about things that we'd like to move forward. But eventually, I would just like to be on a panel talking about my books, not about queer love and queer representation, whatever. But you know, that will come. We have to be patient. So we'll stay with you, Laura, and just sticking on the writing thing. Is there any characters that you've written in your books or story arcs that you're particularly proud of?
Yeah, I mean, in my first novel, The Split, there is a character. I mean, it is a rom-com. There is rom and com, but I think it's primarily a love story between a lesbian and her gay best friend, and it's a platonic love story. And Jeremy, the friend, lives with depression, and I think that quite a lot of times in stories. So it's also a book about running. And I was very keen to not make it a book about running curing depression, which is something I see quite a lot. But it was about...
Or yoga or meditation.
Literally
or being
just
a vegan.
Yeah, some fresh air.
Just get out of the house.
Yeah. And so that's a storyline I'm really proud of. And in my second novel, I write a very complicated relationship between a queer person and her parents, and in particular, an absent father and a very sticky, slightly difficult mother. And treading the, like, finding the balance there was really complicated. And that's something I'm really proud of. In my fourth novel, which is coming out next year, and which I'm currently in full editing mode, it's probably the most personal book I've ever written. And I'm always really careful not to, like, stick too much of myself in, although it feels inevitable.
Tell on yourselves, don't you?
Yeah, you do. And with this one, there's no getting away from it. And, you know, without saying too much, that is something I'm super proud of, nervous about, because, you know, when you've really sort of thrown yourself into something, it feels quite sort of like soul-bearing. But, yeah, that feels like an important thing and a challenging thing. And it's actually the first book that I've written where somebody comes out.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So that's like a slight departure from everything else I've done. But that's been an interesting... And coming out slightly later, which is...
There you go. How about you, Tasha?
Can you say anything more about the book, or is it all secret at the moment?
I truly cannot remember what I am allowed to say.
Yeah.
But, like, listen, we're all friends.
Safe space.
Safe space, yeah, that's right. We're declaring our love for each other and we're telling on our books. It's about someone who lives with depression and anxiety, who's lived a very small and sheltered life because of that. And she's an artist. And through, for many reasons, she ends up moving out of her hometown, small, insular, safe, into London. And it's it's a late coming of age story, really. And it's about expressing yourself, trying to put what's in your head outside of your head, which is, you know, something that I do with books, but she does it through a different medium. And letting yourself, you know, live with the ebbs and flows, the ups and downs of life, and maybe fancy someone.
Oh.
It's a rom-com, after all, a queer rom-com.
There'll be some rom and com in it.
There's rom and com, yeah.
Just a bit for spice, yeah. No, it sounds great. I really think that so many people don't come of age when you're meant to come of age, you know what I mean? Especially when you're queer, because often it is delayed by a variety of factors. Sounds like the weather report. And I think so. That I think will resonate with a lot of people. I'm really excited for that.
And I think it's a really honest thing. I think we think as queer people that we have to follow the same route that straight people do. And, you know, happening in our teenage years, and you meet the perfect person, and you have this great time at uni, and da da da, and it doesn't always work out that way. And I think with the pandemic, I think a lot of people have that kind of almost arrested development, I suppose, and they feel like they're not doing life right, they're not doing adulting right if they're not following all of these milestones and keeping up with everyone else. So I think it's, again, it's really important to see that in, see yourself and see characters like that in books, especially rom-coms, which tend to be very glossy and, you know, like, she has the perfect job and, you know, he's beautiful and, you know, whatever. And I as we were saying earlier, the messiness of real life is really important. So, Tasha, over to you.
I haven't been avoiding the question. I don't
at
know why you think that.
Not been avoiding the question in the slightest.
So, what am I proud of in my work? So, a lot of it is oddly not about the queerness necessarily. So, I'm really proud that in The Burning Kingdoms, I found a way to... So, a lot of fantasy has world building that draws on history, and it amalgamates together different historical periods. So it will go a little bit of Renaissance, a little bit of Norse. You know, let's throw them together and produce a mishmash. But non-Western fantasy, although it's existed for a long time, hasn't necessarily been big, let's say. So there hasn't been a lot of that mashing up of different parts of history and mythology, and that's something I really wanted to do in The Burning Kingdoms, and it's something I did, and I'm really proud of it. But on the queer aspect, I really wanted to write a relationship that wasn't necessarily sweet or nice. I think nice is the thing I kind of wanted to avoid. I didn't want it to be polished. I wanted it to be two very difficult people who shouldn't really like each other, who do like each other, who manipulate each other, but are kind of both aware that they're manipulating each other, and maybe there are some knives involved. So that I'm really proud of writing. And actually, my favorite thing is, has anyone seen Bollywood films here? Yeah?
Yes.
So you know there's sometimes, like, before kissing was a thing in Bollywood films, they would have to come up with ways to up the eroticism without anything erotic taking place. So one of the ways they would do that is they'd stick a woman in a white sari and just throw her out in the rain.
In the rain?
Yeah. Like, constantly. And I was, and my editor at the time was also Indian, and she was like, well, why have you not done, like, do you want to do something to up the romance? And I was like, I want a wet sari scene.
In the rain, yeah.
She was like, then why don't you write one? And I was like, excellent, I shall. And I did.
Yay! Excellent. So, On the subject of that, because, I mean...
On the subject of wet saris?
Or? Wet saris in the rain. just kind of like the things that we like to see in books and the things that, you know, aren't always there. Do you ever feel any pressure writing queer stories to kind of say something or to change things with your writing? Laura, should we start with you?
I didn't used to. When I wrote my first book, I was literally just telling a fun little story that I wanted to tell.
Oh, the joy of a debut, honestly.
No idea.
Just like, singing, tapping away, la 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 la, like Carrie Bradshaw.
Yeah.
This is lovely. I've got my little outfit on.
Yeah, 100%.
Drinking my coffee. Yeah. And then it all goes horribly wrong.
Yeah. And then it was like Bambi in Headlights. I was like, this is fine. This is really fun. And then people started reading it.
Mm. It always goes wrong when people stop reading it,
people
I find.
People read it. It was really insane. And then people were saying things to me like, oh, it's the first time I've seen myself in a book like this, and it made me feel, you know, all of these nice things. And I try not to put too much pressure on myself because I can only be one thing. This is the problem with queerness and publishing. Because it's so underrepresented, we are meant to you feel a pressure to represent everything all at once, which is impossible.
We're not a monolith.
Exactly.
You know.
And so rather than putting everything into my own writing, bearing in mind I will write outside of my lived experience, but I can only write knowledgeably about my own experience, is to uplift work that is outside of my own experience. And so I feel like as an author, that is something far more valuable that I can do, rather than trying to stick everything in one book where it all becomes diluted and quite meaningless, which would be incredibly easy to do. And I sometimes read books and it feels like a list of tick. Yeah, totally. And I completely understand why you would want to do that. And it's done with the best will in the world, and it feels like a lot of the story and the heart has been lost.
Yeah.
I
go.
Okay. Not to get on my soapbox, but I think there is a lot of pressure to do good representation. You're right, when there aren't that many queer writers, even now, even as things have changed, there's still not that many queer stories out there. You do feel a lot of pressure to give good representation. But I once saw a picture of a sign that said keep off the grass and like a little dog balancing on the sign. And I was like, that's me. Like, I want to be on the grass if they tell me not to be on it. And I think that it's important to have a huge variety of representation. And so I try and really strongly push to write the stories that I instinctually want to write, which are messy. And I also think there's like, this sounds a bit loaded, but like an almost internalized fascism in saying that this is what queerness needs to look like. And if we do anything that's messy or evil or awful in fiction, we're being bad, right? So I kind of internally want to push away from that a lot in my own work and try and write romances, yes, in fantasy, but ones that are imperfect.
I love that. Right. Well, as I said earlier, we are trying to keep things positive. But I think it would be a bit naive and maybe remiss not to mention what's happening in America with books like this being banned I know After Love was banned as soon as it was published in America because it's got two girls kissing on the cover, so of course they put that straight on the bonfire. And I've actually, my new book, I've dedicated it to the teachers, librarians and booksellers that are fighting the good fight and making sure that these stories get into the hands of the readers that need them. So I just wanted to ask you guys what your thoughts on what's happening with these books being banned. Does it make you more determined to write these stories?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I write for adults, so I haven't personally, you know, my books have not been banned yet.
There's always time.
There's still time. They might be being banned right now. Who knows? But my friend Melinda Lowe.
I love Melinda.
She wrote a book that is extremely special to me called Last Night at the Telegraph Club.
Yes. And it won the National Book.
Won the National Book Award Prize, whatever. And that has been banned in schools is just heartbreaking because
it's a stunning book.
It's
just
a
beautifully
stunning
written
book, and it's just perfect. It's so well told, and it's romantic, and it's just so I just love it. And for that has been taken away from young people in schools, and it covers so much. It covers queerness. It covers being a first generation Chinese American in the 1950s and what that looks like. And it's about a woman aspiring, you know, to work in STEM, and she's just this incredible person. And it just breaks my heart. And when I think about the book ban, that's the book that I think about the most. So yeah, it does make me want to write more stories and be more, when I talk about having like queer as a qualifier and, you know, wanting to move away from that, we are not in that place right now, and it makes me want to be louder. And like I was saying before, uplift the voices that are being squashed. Like, I feel like for me, that's what I can do.
I think you said that beautifully.
Yes, yeah. That was beautifully put.
I agree. I think also there's a really, like, to bring the tone down, a cynical part of me that is aware that there was a really interesting flourishment and rise of queer fiction and queer art that got crushed in, you know, one of the world wars. I think it was the second one, probably. So, you know, I don't think history is cyclical. I don't think, you know, we have more queer representation now and it's going to be dashed and then it will come back again. I think that there are certain patterns of ideology and oppression that are very effective and get used over and over again. So I think it's our responsibility to resist by writing our fiction and by being public about ourselves, if we can, if it's safe, if we feel like we are able to, and writing our stories. And I was previously a librarian. So, yeah, I was in sciences, though, for my sins. But I remember doing a lot of, you know, research and work on, you know, neutrality and the way that publishing and libraries believe in neutrality, and how that's a really false concept, because neutrality usually ends up meaning that you lean on the side of the oppressor rather than the oppressed. So some really interesting work about that around cataloguing, which I won't go into because that's really boring to anyone who's not me.
No, I'd love it. Let's discuss it afterwards.
I will tell you all about it. But it's horrible to think that, you know, writing is something that should be joyful and fun and we should be able to just love books and enjoy them, but that there is this political weight around it at the same time.
Yeah, I think one of the things that shocked me was, I mean, I've been fighting the good fight for, 10, 11 years now, and I was absolutely thrilled when I saw the cover of After Love, and it's basically an illustration of two girls kissing. I just cried. I was like, oh my God, and one of them's brown as well, and it was just like, this is amazing. And then I started getting messages on Instagram and TikTok from readers saying, I really love your book, but I can't read it because of the cover. I can't buy it because we have a family Amazon account. I can't even get it on Kindle. And one girl told me that she had ordered it to her friend's house and was reading it at her friend's house, but she couldn't take it home with her. And then librarians as well were like kind of keeping it under the table for people and, you know, reading it between lessons and stuff. But It kind of, and then people were asking me, could you do another cover that has is like a little bit more neutral so the girls aren't kissing? And this is going to be the most UKYA story ever. But I was at Holly Bourne's wedding, and I told this to Juno Dawson and Samantha Shannon. And I said, can you believe? And like they both went nuts, especially Juno. And she was just like, for God's sake, we've been fighting for these covers for years. And now we have one. They want us to go back to having a neutral cover that, that these kids can read because their parents don't get it. But the thing that I took out of it, as depressing as that was, is that they still found a way to read it. And they still got their hands on it, and they wanted that book so badly that they were reading it at their friend's house, or they were reading it in between lessons and in the school library. And I think that is the difference between what is being said when these books are being banned about how dangerous they are and, you know, corruptive and we're trying to groom kids or whatever, and the actual reality of the kids that are reading these books. So that's what I wanted to ask you guys, is what has been the actual response from readers? Not what's on Fox News or in the Times or the Sun or whatever, but what have people actually said about your books? Should we start with you, Tasha, for a change?
I think what's been interesting is I kind of had a feeling that the audience for this book would... And the audience has been broad, which has been lovely, but I get a fair number of emails from queer women of colour, mostly, a lot of them Asian, and saying things like, you know, I love this book, thank you so much for writing it. And you realise how much it actually matters. And when I think about it, that makes sense, because for me, if I, you know, in the darkest days, if I'd read, you know, a lesbian Indian story, I would have just cried. I would have been so
sobbed
happy.
Sobbed my eyes out.
Yeah. And oddly enough, when you were talking about the covers, I remember seeing my book on a list of discreet covers and discreet blurbs. And that makes sense. I can think of a lot of people, even, you know, my age now, who probably couldn't read it in their, you know, shared households, who couldn't have something that was visibly queer. And that's terrible. But I'm glad that the books are out there and that somehow they are reaching people.
Yeah, I the feedback I've got from people, I actually asked people, not for my own ego, for an article I was writing, what it is about queer rom-coms that, you know, appeal to you. Why would you pick one up? And a lot of queer readers said they can relax. They know that nothing's going to happen to the queer character that they
kill the gays thing.
Yeah, it's not going to, and they don't have to worry that the queerness is going to be something that they like cringe at, or that's been written clumsily, or is a side storyline to support straight characters. They are front and center. Gay best friend. Yeah, they're front and center. They can. They know that ultimately, if there's not a happy ending, there's going to be a hopeful ending at the bare minimum. And that, especially with my books, and this isn't the case with all books, and it's not necessarily, you know, it's not the only way to write, but I write with my characters, and I'm always really kind to them. And so even if they go through a hard time, I'm going to treat them with kindness and treat them with care, and then that will translate to the readers, and it seems to have done that. I think they're quite a safe place.
That is really lovely. I never thought about that with rom-coms. As someone that wrote a book where literally I kill... It wasn't kill gays, like everyone dies. Like it's indiscriminate. It's about Grim Reapers. So literally everyone dies. I was worried about that. And I remember calling a friend and being like, oh God, is it a kill your gays thing? She's like, Tanya, no, everyone dies. It's nothing to do with them being gay, or no one commits suicide because they've been outed or whatever. And I was like, oh good, right, fine. I'll just kill everyone then. That's just the safest bet. I think what we're going to do now is open up to questions before we come back and do a little closing discussion. So if anybody has... I'm not sure what the format is. Is there a microphone or... Oh, yes. Excellent. We've got roving mics. So that sounds exciting. Hello, we have a question here. Can we get one of the roving mics? Do you want to borrow mine? Oh, no, there's one there. Excellent. Thank you. Oh, the lights have come up. I can see you now. Hi. How's it going?
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's very Wonderful. I got 1,000 million questions, but I'm going to reduce it.
Okay.
Dude, I want you to define fantasy books.
Oh.
Whenever I read a book, I befriend the characters or I hate the characters. And my question, my real question is for the three of you, is about not censorship, but imposition. When I was a kid, I'm very old now, when I was a kid, it was every queer character ended badly.
Yeah, that's what
and,
we're saying.
And it's not censorship that you are not allowed because of false morality. It is all about that people end badly.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. So first of all, you want a fantasy, a definition of fantasy, and then you want us to comment on gay people, queerness in books always ending badly. Is that right?
Sorry. Where is the border, the frontier between imposition and reality when you've been talking yourself about
yeah.
in America you cannot publish, you are banned,
yeah.
blah, blah, blah. So how to overcome all that?
Oh, how to overcome that. Right, got you. Okay. So should we start with the fantasy question?
Yes. It stuff's made up. That's it. So, like, it's so a rom-com is there's romance and comedy. A fantasy would be there's romance and comedy, but somebody flies in on a dragon.
And there's swords.
Yeah, and there's swords.
Knives. Yeah.
Yeah, that kind of thing. It's just the you know, the stuff we find in, and I don't mean this as a denigration of religion, it's the stuff we find in religion. It's the things that we cannot see or touch that are nonetheless very important to us that we make, you know, the castles we make in the sky. That's fantasy. But it can have lots of different forms.
I see I can write fantasy. I haven't got, much of an imagination. I can only write what I know. Right, so what we're now going to talk about is how we overcome. So, Laura, do you want to take that one? Go on, Laura.
Sure, I've got an answer prepared for how we overcome.
We shall overcome.
I suppose, I mean, it's what we were saying earlier.
Yeah.
All we can do, well, all I feel I can do, I don't want to speak for anyone else, is carry on doing what I'm doing.
I mean, thank God we have a platform.
Yeah, have a platform.
Yeah.
I mean, I just feel like I'm in an incredibly privileged position, and I'm allowed to keep writing my books and talking about them and being really proud of them. And as far as I possibly can, I'm going to keep doing that and encourage other people to do that and encourage other queer writers to write and write proudly and about who they are and tell their stories. And that sort of feels like where we are right now.
I think that's, I mean, I was saying earlier in the group, I work with a lot of unpublished writers. So it's, for me, it's a case of not pulling the ladder up behind me, making sure that I am amplifying all the voices, that I am kind of championing new writers. And, you know, that's all we can do really is just be, you know, after spending like 40 years in the closet, like I am out and I'm not going to shut up about it. And you can burn my books and I don't give a four-angled fuck, frankly. So that's the only way that I know how to deal with it. And you know, maybe I will never hit the bestseller list, or maybe I'll never have a Netflix kind of, you know, series, but I don't care. So, another question that I've ended on. Oh, they're all on this side. I love that. What is that? Right, should we go on this side? But there is one over here. Right. That gentleman there with the grey... I'm assuming gender there. That person there with a grey sweatshirt on.
Yeah, thank you very much. I just wondered what you think about representation of queer characters in books written by straight people.
We were just talking about that in the green room and I was like, we can't be bitchy about it.
Has it improved in terms of amount and quality of the characters?
I have to say, like, I'm going to just be completely honest. It's a safe space. It does my nutter that some of the biggest queer books are written by straight people and straight women in particular. It also does my nutter that they're about men, because I would love to see, and I was actually going to talk about this probably a little bit more diplomatically in closing, but I would love to see more lesbian female-female stories. I think there is a bit of a thing with male-male stories, a bit fetishized, middle-aged women have to fancy someone in the pairing, and then all of a sudden, you know, they're queer allies, putting rainbow flags in their Twitter profiles. As you can probably tell, it really annoys me. But, yeah, I think... I don't know. I don't even know what to say. I've just gone off on one.
I feel like a conversation that's been had quite a lot. I loved it. is about A Little Life.
Oh, God, yeah.
And it's a real... when I read that, poolside on holiday and ruined my holiday.
I was going to say, did you just, like, cry your face off?
Solidly.
Like stand up and walk into the pool and
say, yeah, I would have just walked into the sea.
I was like, this is it. There's like, it was
fun,
awful soul destroying.
And with Laura Kay.
Yeah. It was, I felt really strange reading it. And I realized the strangeness was that I felt voyeuristic reading it. And it felt like, and maybe there's fans of it in here, and it's each their own. It's a hugely popular
safe
book.
Safe space.
It felt like a torture your gaze book. And she was doing it from a position of, I don't want to assume her sexuality. I don't think she's come out, though.
This is another thing. I'm not going to make anyone come out to prove that they can write queer stories. I'm not doing that. As long as you do it with integrity and you do it properly.
Yeah.
In the same way that if I was writing a book about a surgeon, I would expect to get it right. If you want to write a queer story, everyone can write a queer story, but we can always tell.
Totally,
the point.
And it felt like I wondered at the end of the book, why did you make this person queer, and what would the purpose for this story, and I wonder what you were trying to say, and I'm still not entirely sure what that is, other than just it was bleak and sad and awful, and I was just, and those stories are important, but whether she was the right person to tell that story.
Well, are you the right person to tell that story? Exactly.
I question.
Tasha?
I've really got nothing to add. I've just enjoyed this.
Just enjoying me ruining my career by slagging off loads of...
I think that, you know, with anything like this, that's anything about representation, it's very, very complicated. And there are loads of different perspectives and facets. And there's always a but if, when, therefore, blah, blah, blah. You know, so, yeah, it would be nice to see more queer writers, out queer writers, getting big support and getting big pushes. That would be wonderful. Also, we don't know how many of those straight writers are in fact straight or cis. We just don't, because many people are not out, and sometimes it takes a long time for people to come to their own conclusions about who they are. And certainly from, from fan fiction, I've seen a lot of people who think they are straight women realise they're not women or straight through writing things. So sometimes that can be part of the exploration. But all of these things can simultaneously be true, which is complicated and gives me a headache, but... is what it is.
Well, this is what we were going to talk about in conclusion, is like where we see things going. And I just want to be clear that you can write whatever you want to write, as long as, like I said, you do it properly, you do it with respect, you do it with integrity. My concern is it becoming a fad? Is it a new way, a new angle to sell a book? You know, and there are always going to be people that will try and capitalize on that. But as long as stories are told, they're brave and they're beautiful and they don't harm anyone in the process, I'm good. But would it be nice to have more female stories? Yes, it would. All right, we had one question over here.
The question I wanted to ask the three of you, because you've touched on it, is how much collaboration do you have with your publishers in how your books are represented? So you talked about the cover of your book, you talked about, quotes, discreet blurb, you talked about marketing it as a sapphic love story because that sells on various platforms. We've fallen foul of the blurb thing because one of Adam's books, it says on the blurb, Rent Boy. And that fell foul of lots of algorithms online. Even if we'd said sex worker or whatever, it still would have fallen foul. So how have you found the collaboration between you and your publishers? And where is the line where you've said, no, I want that cover, or yes, I'll produce an alternative cover, or blurb, or whatever?
I mean, I've been very lucky. The rule is with me, whether they know it or not, I don't know if they know it, but it is in my head. I write the words and you deal with the covers and marketing, publicity, title, all of that sort of stuff. You don't touch my words and I won't tell you how to do your job. So, for example, when I asked to drop the sapphic love story thing, I was told it trends on TikTok and it's a big thing. I'm going to let that go because you are the experts here. As long as you don't try and touch the words, that's cool. And I have to say, being completely honest, After Love was the first cover that I ever had that I liked. And often, as authors, you have to let it go. You have no choice. Invariably, the cover comes in, and they've already shown it to Waterstones, they've already shown it to Tesco's, they've already shown it to Foyles. Like, 100 people have seen it before you have. And they're like, yeah, this is tested really well with Waterstones. In other words, like it or lump it. But I was very lucky because I have an editor who understood, because when I sold Afterlove, I had meetings with, I think, about 4 or 5 different editors before I signed with the editor that I have, because she got it, and she wasn't just walking talking the talk, she was walking the walk. I mean, she also publishes Dean Atta, who wrote The Black Flamingo. So I had a bit of faith. But there is that moment when you open the PDF and you're just like, oh my God, what is it? What is it? And that's why I cried when I saw it, because I was like, it's the first time. And Sarah Maxwell, who illustrated it, is queer, and she's also illustrated the new cover. So I'm very lucky, but I know my experience is not everyone's experience. But then I'm also 10 years in, so how about you guys? How's it been for you guys?
It's been an interesting journey with my books. So I feel lucky that I have publishers that are willing to admit when something hasn't worked and try again with something that might work better. So I'm published by the same people that published Beth O'Leary.
Oh, I love Beth.
I love Beth. And she's amazing. And she has a very particular style of cover. Mm-hmm. They all tie in together. And what they were keen to do with me is give me Beth O'Leary's covers.
Yeah, they do.
They wanted to make me Beth O'Query.
I love that.
Oh, I've been waiting to do it. We've got 8 minutes left, and I was getting
it. She got it in under the wire.
and it didn't resonate with me. Beth and I both write rom-coms, but mine are very different to hers, and we're two different writers. You don't have to smush people together and make them one thing. And
so
we
trying to trick readers into like going into bookshop and thinking, oh, that's totally the book I liked last time.
Yeah,
never gonna work, especially with queer characters.
Yeah, exactly. We have a different audience, and so I remember with the first book, I almost said nothing because I was just so grateful that it was happening.
And we're very grateful.
We're
publishing it. You should be so grateful.
It's
people want this job.
Yeah, exactly. With the second book, they did me a cover that was not dissimilar to Beth's, and I kicked up a fuss. And I was like, this doesn't represent what happens in the book, and it doesn't represent me. It's a really sexy book, and it's really it's all set over this hot summer, and it was just a very sort of like what felt like quite clinical and cold cover. And they listened to me, and they came back, they got a new designer, and they came back with this cover, which is, you'll see it on the table of books for sale outside. It's two women's faces very close together, just about to kiss. And it's like, it's gorgeous, and I love it. And it was the first cover where I was like, yes, this is what I wanted. And my sweet editor said to me, isn't it lovely? They look like they're chatting.
Yeah, gal pals.
And I was like, we're nearly there.
almost.
That's so sweet. Oh, bless her. I really wanted, so me and my editor spoke, and she said, is there anything you really want on the cover? And I was like, they're not going to listen to what I want, but I'm going to say it anyway.
Try.
Yeah. And I was like, I've seen lots of, this is an epic fantasy. That was the point. So an epic fantasy is, there are many books and many things happen and many points of view. Game of Thrones. There we go. And I was like, I've seen a lot of epic fantasy with very, generic covers they sell, but I've seen a lot where it's like a man with a sword and he's walking towards the camera, I guess, and he's got a hood on or something and he's cool. And I was like, I want that kind of cover, but I want a woman, and I want her to be clearly Indian, and I want her to be like dressed in South Asian clothing, because I have never seen a fantasy novel with a cover like that. She's like, cool, let's do it. So we did, and so I felt really heard and listened to, which was really wonderful. And I loved the cover of The Oleander Sword, actually, because it has like big step on me energy. So, and I think the best feedback I got from readers once is someone was like, I just want her to choke me or something. Sorry, it's 11 a.m.
Oh my God,
and
right,
I was like, yes,
okay.
That's the vibe.
We've gone there. Because the thing is, it's not quite, we're almost in midday, so you're all right.
It's acceptable at midday,
yeah,
right?
I think so, yeah. Excellent. Oh, I love that. Right. We've got 6 minutes. I think we've got time for one more very quick. Oh, gosh, there's loads of questions. Right. Everyone's pointing towards this person. Yes. Yes. Oh, is it? We've got 15 minutes. Okay, we've got plenty of time, so keep going. Hello.
Hi. So I actually have a two-parter. I'm so sorry. But with the discussion of A Little Life, I've personally read it. I have a lot of mixed negative feelings about it. And I was wondering if you could talk about, you know, the, I guess, excess of suffering when it comes to writing about, like, queer characters, and just kind of, like, discuss that a bit more. And then I'm also really interested in, like, the discussion surrounding how there's so little representation of, like, sapphic romance and things like that. Even in communities, like, I mean, you mentioned fan fiction, which is predominantly, I guess, made up of queer women. There's still so little that focuses on, you know, like, lesbian relationships or queer women in general. And I just wanted to hear more about that from you guys.
I mean, I was saying earlier that what bugs me is that sapphic romance is for lesbians and male romance, gay romance is for everyone else. And that is one of the things that I would like to see change and it become more balanced, I suppose. What do you guys think?
I can talk about my genre particularly think it's a little bit of an odd case. So I love Access of Suffering. I'm going to take that. I really
Access
want to.
Access of Suffering.
Yeah, and we can talk about that. But in terms of representation of sapphic relationships, I think oddly enough, fantasy is one space in which there is probably more sapphic representation than there is. Do we call it Achillean or gay? You know, male relationships. And I think that's quite interesting in a lot of ways because there is definitely a sudden, unexpected market for sapphic fantasy. There was The Priory of the Orange Tree by Samantha Shannon, which became a New York Times bestseller, had a really big level of support behind it, and I'm really glad it did because it helped me sell my book. And then there were a bunch of books that came out. So there was like The Traitor Barrack Hormon, which is actually a much older book. There was The Unbroken. There was my book. There was She Became the Sun, which all came out almost simultaneously and got called the sapphic trifecta. So, and as not necessarily as a result of that, but on the wave, there is a fair bit of sapphic fantasy. Far less male fantasy, especially from queer male authors. So it's kind of a weird exception. I don't really know why. I can't explain it, but I think it's just a reflection of scarcity. I think that there's not enough queer across the umbrella fiction. And I don't know why fantasy particularly has gone in this direction.
Do you think it's because it takes more risks, that people are more open-minded when it comes to fantasy?
No.
Well, then, that answers that question.
I think that publishing is by its nature really risk-averse. And
I mean the readers rather than publishing.
The readers. I think that there seem to be a lot of readers who want queer female relationships in fantasy. I don't know why there are more of them there than perhaps in other genres, but there are a fair few. And I think it's interesting, and I wonder if TikTok's been part of it, actually.
Yeah. Do you know what else I think has been huge, and this is going to be quite controversial, is The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo, which, I don't know if anybody here's read it, absolutely massive on TikTok. It's ridiculous how big that book is on TikTok. So I read it because I thought, well, I just want to see what the fuss is about, and was absolutely thrilled and stunned to learn that it was a sapphic love story. I actually brought tears to my eyes, not just because, I mean, it's a good book. I mean, it's not fantastic, but it's a good book. But I was just like, people love this book, and it's, you know, it's sapphic, and it made my heart so happy because people love that book. And I do think maybe it has opened publishing up to taking more risks. Maybe? Yeah. Am I being...
No. I feel like, with the examples that you've both just given, so in fantasy and then Seven Husbands, which I really enjoyed, like you say.
It's a huge page-turner. It's so popular, my agent says.
But the lesbians in it, or the queer characters in it, it's historical, and it is set within the context of it being forbidden. And I think that there is a safety for readers and in the people who make the decisions about stories that get told in telling historical stories. Like, so I see a lot of this in film and TV, especially of like really tragic lesbian stories, Ammonite, that are like actually really boring. But they're so safe because these women are not in any way challenging to any modern day audience. So like you can look back and go, oh, wasn't it awful? Oh, those sweet women holding hands and looking at each other on the beach. Oh, it's so romantic and tragic, blah, blah, blah. Lesbians today is a much more challenging, or lesbians in the real world today is a much more challenging prospect, because if you're looking for a wide audience, like men to want to go and see it, straight women, it's who are these people and what space do they occupy in the world? Are they taking up my space? What does this relationship look like? And what is the power dynamic? I don't get it. Like, ultimately, who's the man? Like, and
who's the husband, who's the wife?
Yeah, I mean, I did a panel for my last book, and the person that was interviewing said, don't you find it hard to write? And I was like, what? And she was like, well, how do you know when you're writing two women? Who's the man? And I was like,
Does she mean who's the top, or like what?
She basically meant who occupies the male space. I mean, I switched off at that point. I was actually with, I was with another author, Lily Linden, who Tasha also knows, who also writes queer rom-coms, and she's fantastic and professional. And she carried on answering the questions, and I was like, yeah. I think that answers sort of vaguely the second half of your question. Do you want to talk about access to suffering?
I might just add really quickly that actually, like, no, not to be a big geek, but in fantasy there is a lot of stuff that's queer norm, like where queer is normative, there's always something else horribly wrong. Like The Unbroken, queer people are accepted. There's also colonialism. That's more of a problem. The point about the real world, I think, is still extremely valid.
It's really interesting because fantasy isn't the real world. Historical isn't the real world. And then obviously, you know, what I was just saying earlier about my cover with Afterlove. If you look at Seven Husbands, you wouldn't know it was sapphic at all. You could quite happily read that and just think it's about a pretty girl in a dress. So, yeah, I think this brings us back, so we're circling back to what is it so forbidden about female stories that male stories, you know, like stuff like It's a Sin that's been hugely popular and, you know, lauded and award-winning and stuff. Where's our female version of that? Or Heartstopper, or, you know, like Raw Blood, that Red, Raw, Red, White,
Red,
and
White
Royal
and Blue.
Blue. Yeah. Where's ours?
She wrote One Last Stop, which was
was
really cool. Love that.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just plugging it.
Of course, yes. Yeah.
Axis of suffering.
Go on. You need to talk about the axis of suffering. Yeah.
Oh, I love that term. It's just great.
Yeah.
I think that we read fiction for a lot of different reasons, right? And I think that seeing characters suffer is one of them. If you know, there's a lot of fiction about, for example, feminism and women's rights that really dives into reproductive justice and, you know, and horrible domestic violence experiences, and it really lingers on them. And part of that is catharsis, because seeing those things in fiction that we've experienced allows us to feel a certain catharsis, or to experience that trauma and emotions in a way that's safe. Or maybe not safe, it's just what art does. And I think that there is still a lot of, there's a lot of queer fiction by queer people or queer adjacent people that deals with suffering, because there is suffering within the queer experience due to homophobia and transphobia. And we need a space in which to explore that, whether that is through the lens of the fantastical or the real world. I think those spaces are really important. But there is also a history of writing queer people as tragic figures who die. Much like there is a racist history of depictions of non-white people, that as authors we have to contend with, because that's what the history and the tropes and the tradition we're writing in brings to us subconsciously. So there's two axes of suffering, I think, that we have to, one that you can choose to play with and one that kind of comes to you that then you have to grapple with.
Excellent. Right, shall we have one more question? Oh. Right, so there's, should we go to this person in the middle? I'm just picking sides at this point. there we go. Thank you.
You've touched upon publishing, but do you think that the rise of platforms such as TikTok have changed your approach to writing, like queer characters? And do you think it's positively or negatively impacted fiction?
TikTok, I don't know what's going on over there. I wish them well. They're having a lot of fun. I'm not getting involved. But what I will say is that someone on TikTok reviewed my book, After Love, and said it was like the best book she'd ever read and everyone should buy it. And we sold 1,200 copies on that day. And After Love, because of that, outsold all my other books in 3 months. I honestly don't know what's going on over there, but I love them, and I hope they keep recommending my books. It's astonishing. Book Talk is huge. And I have gone over there and had a little look, and they just seem to be talking about the same books over and over. So, you know, Evelyn Hugo and Circe seems to be their big book that they love, and, you know, Red, White and Royal Blue, and but whatever. It's not affecting my writing. That, to me, is promotion and marketing. That's nothing to do with the words that I'm writing. But it has been really lovely how many, like, videos that I've seen of girls being like, where's my poppy? And, you know, like, I'm not settling for anything less than this, which is just lovely. And so it's a really nice way of kind of actually seeing readers in a way that I never have before, because of, you know, I don't read Goodreads reviews or whatever. So yeah, it is, it's really interesting. What is interesting is trying to see publishing, trying to understand it and monetize it in a way that it can, because it's feral, it's absolutely feral over there. And I just wish them well on that, really, because I don't think it's going to work. Because the problem is, as soon as you start sponsoring posts, people aren't going to believe, you know, the reviews are, I think it needs to be more organic than that. But, you know, good luck to them.
That's what I think about. That's what TikTok is like. It's sort of a mystery to most people in publishing.
So chaotic. I love it.
But it feels like that's why it's such an exciting space, because it's all organic. Like, it's actual readers saying what they love. And it feels like, you know, you see a lot of books on Instagram and it's not the same because, you know they've been sent up by publishers and it's ad and gift and this and that. TikTok is just real people being super excited. Yeah. There's nothing we can do to influence that. You just have to write what you're writing and hope someone picks it up and makes a viral video about it.
And it's a lot realer than Instagram with all the lay, and don't get me wrong, I know people spend an inordinate amount of time on the lay flats and the pictures that they take, and they're beautiful. I mean, I don't know why I have a lot of Taylor Swift fans, and they do like the friendship bracelets, and then they do another thing which is super cool, where they take albums, like when Midnights came out, for example, and they will recommend books per song on the album, which is brilliant. Love it. Happy days. So they are very ingenious in that sense. And then I've got another reader who has really good taste in music, and she's done Mitzi and she's done Hozier and she's done Boy Genius albums, which is fantastic. But TikTok, you get to see their face and you get to see how excited they are or not excited. You know, and you just, like, they do a bad review and you're like, thank God it was my book. Oh my God. Like, their secondhand embarrassment, even though it isn't your book, is, you know, real. What about you? What's your experience on TikTok, Tasha?
I mean, I'm on there. I like it.
You're one of those people that are actually on there.
Yeah, it's fine. Oh, I mean, okay. I watch a lot of cat videos. There's a lady who cuts wood. She's nice.
Oh, I thought you meant as an author you were on there.
Oh yeah, I am. But like.
Oh, okay.
I when I went on there, I decided I'd do as much as I felt like, and I've stuck to that, which is just haven't done it in months. But I do go on there when I feel like it. I think it is a feral space, but all the social media essentially is. Like, all publicity...
The best places are feral, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, all publicity marketing can do is get your book out to as many people as possible.
Yeah.
Ideally, the people who are probably going to like it, and then they have to decide if they like it. No one can control that. So there was a whole... Like, even any social media is like this. So I don't know if anyone still uses Twitter, alas.
No. I have to say, my marketing and PR plan, we're not even factoring Twitter into it.
We're not sure
it's going to be there in February when the book comes out.
But even as it's sort of slowly descending into the ether... There was a point where somebody whose username was Bigolus Dickolus.
Said,
everyone should read this book, and talked about This Is How You Lose the Time War, which came out 3 years ago and it hit the New York Times bestseller list. You can't predict that.
What annoyed me was, like, he said, this is the most underrated book ever. And I was like, it's got 22,000 reviews on Amazon and won a Hugo. Where do the rest of us stand if that is considered underrated?
Every book is underrated if you haven't heard of it, though.
Well, that is true.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is mad, the influence that these viral... But again, you can't harness it. You cannot predict it.
I think you just have to be chilled about it, right?
You have to let it go.
You can't worry about it.
No.
I mean, I think as writers, we're immensely grateful when people enjoy a book and they talk about it. But also, it's nobody's job to do that, and it's not our job to make them do that. It just has to happen if it's going to happen.
And I think it's so joyful when it does, because it's just like it feels real rather than, you know, the hashtag SponCon kind of thing. Right, so we're going to start. Oh, more questions. Okay. Have you got time for one more?
No, I'm shy, of course. This is kind of maybe a bit out there, but have you all read a book that was a big influence on me some years ago, which is Marge Piercy, Woman on the Edge of Time? I think just maybe there is a bit of a thing in it that it's a... what's your genre? Sorry, I forgot your name in the middle, but the speculative realism, is it?
No, epic fantasy. The dragon's bit rather than the real world bit.
I'm thinking more of the speculative realism, maybe it is. Is that a genre?
Yeah.
Anyway, I was thinking more in a... Woman on the Edge of Time is basically a very political feminist and, you know, covers a whole load of issues. And I was interested in the genre of fiction that you write as being a vehicle for addressing within maybe, and I say younger because that sounds a bit patronising, but a particular audience to access views about or consider views about the world situation and what's going on in terms of the war and the wars. And, you know, I'm curious about how much you feel like the vehicle of fiction is an opportunity for bringing people into an understanding of some wider political issues around. Does that make sense?
Fantasy in particular can be... I mean, it can be many things. So fantasy can be... just a fun fantasy. It can be a space where you have a really nice time and you have an adventure and you go into another world and then you come back and you're like, that was great. I enjoyed reading that story. But even those books, to come back to the question of neutrality, are not neutral, because the format of a fantasy and the way a fantasy world is built has been built on a history of other fantasy worlds, probably starting with Tolkien, who was inspired by things like Beowulf, right? Who was consciously trying to create a mythic British past that didn't exist. And blah, 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 that produced this book and that book and that book, and you see the echoes of that in little epic fantasy. So there are political choices you have to make when you're writing a fantasy world. Do you have kings and queens? What are you saying about monarchy? What are you saying about democracy? What are you saying about queerness? Is your world queer normative? Is it homophobic? The Unbroken, which I mentioned earlier by C.L. Clarke, deals almost directly with colonialism, particularly French colonialism in North Africa, even though it's not North Africa, but you feel the echoes of that. So I think I don't know that educate is the job of any of that fiction, but it is an exploration of a question that may not have an easy answer, which is true of a lot of fiction, right? But it's something that fantasy does as well. Some authors are purposely trying to engage with that unanswerable question, and some are just, you know, writing a cool story, and I don't think either of those things are necessarily wrong. Yeah.
Excellent, that was really well put. Right, so I think we are almost done. I just wanted to end on a kind of more positive note and to talk about our hopes for the future. I know we've touched on a little bit of it already, but, you know, my concern is always with these things, with any sort of diversity thing, that it's a fad and, you know, it's just a way of selling books. So what I would like to do is discuss our hopes for the future for the industry. I'll just start by saying that I've just read... I'm about 30 pages off finishing All Our Wives Under the Sea.
That's great.
It's such a good book. And I think that book represents what I want in the future. It's a queer story, you know, woman and wife, thriller, horror, romance, and that's it. You know, the queerness, it isn't about coming out. It isn't about how difficult their lives are and, you know, homophobia or anything like that. It's just a straight-up horror story. A horror romance, which I didn't even think was a thing, but I love it now. So I think that represents to me what I want going forward. And female, you know, as we were saying earlier. But what about you guys?
Within the genre that I write, I would love to see more trans representation. I feel like we've got to a place where publishers are very comfortable publishing like my queer rom-com or you know, Justin Meyer's queer rom-coms or Matt Cain's queer rom-coms, and I would love to read a rom-com about trans people where the story isn't about them being trans, they happen to be trans, and the story is about them falling in love. And I think we are still in a place in publishing where that would be hugely radical. And I think if someone was brave enough to take the step, then it would be really exciting and massively popular. And so that is what I would like to see. For I think publishers are doing, I'm trying to keep it positive, a lot of backpacking. They're backpatting of each other.
Exactly, yeah.
And they're very pleased with themselves because of every once a year they have a panel where they all tell each other how well they're doing and they wheel out all their gay authors and there's rainbows everywhere.
Well, being brown as well, it's great because I tick two boxes.
Of course, yeah. So you get wheeled out twice? Yeah. And I would love for a publisher to be like, you know what, this is a commitment beyond the fad or beyond wanting to get massive on BookTok. This is who we are and this is where we're going to put our money. And I think if someone actually did that, did a huge like Emily Henry style campaign behind someone writing commercial fiction, that would be really exciting. So that is my hope. My hope is that it's not a fad. My hope is that publishers will put their money where their mouth is and carry on doing what they're doing.
Just as an aside, I can't remember the title, but Victoria Lee just wrote a book with a trans romance. And I don't know if it's out in the UK, but if you look up that name...
Yes.
Yeah, it's the one where this girl, I think, has a one-night stand and then realises it's her trans professor. Or something, and then
That sounds right on my street. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I can't remember the title though. I'm sorry, Victoria Lee. Just look up that name. I think that I just want to see this continue. I'm like not to take the tone down, but I am worried it won't. So I would like to see queer fantasy and science fiction and queer fiction in general continue to have a really strong presence and, you know, let's say dominate the market. That would be ideal.
I mean, Heartstopper's done pretty well.
It's a medium success, isn't it?
A couple of people have read it.
But also, fantasy romance is becoming a really big thing at the moment and it is at this time quite straight and white. And if somebody doesn't write a sapphic villain romance, I'm going to fight God. So that needs to happen.
Write it then.
I want someone else to do it so I can read it. It's not the same.
This is the problem when you write what we write. You've got to write it yourself if you want it. But I think this is a really nice note to end on and just to say that we want all of this, and I assume you guys want all of this, keep reading these books. And the best way to do that is to come along to festivals like this and support us and talk about us and our books on TikTok and Instagram or wherever, and maybe buy them. And they now are available to sell, to purchase at the bookshop outside. You'll be helping some queer authors. I am a local queer author as well, so you should buy two of mine. And I think that's a really nice note to end it on. Buy our books. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for moderating us. So amazing.
Oh my gosh, I absolutely love this. It's got me so excited about the next festival. If you enjoyed it, you absolutely need to get your super early bird ticket to the Posters Queer. Make sure you are signed up to the mailing list and head over to the website. Give them a follow on Instagram over at Posters Queer Fest for exclusive content and offers. Also, if you use the code PODCAST20 at checkout, you can get 20% off the price of all tickets. This doesn't include workshops. Workshops need to be booked separately as they have many less seats in them. So we'll be back in a couple of weeks with another great revisiting of a 2023 Coasters Queer event. This was one of my favourite ones with Joelle Taylor and Abby Fellows talking about the undercurrent of class in queer literature. Thank you so much for listening.